Natalie.
So today. So the text Bodhicitta Vivarana, the commentary on awakening, begins with the different philosophical systems. It goes through from the beginning, and then towards the end, it also deals with bodhicitta. And you debated on bodhicitta, this altruistic spirit of enlightenment, which has been very good. Thank you. So first, I wish to... I want everyone to recite this prayer of the seven Nalanda masters on the skillfully conveying the marvelous approaches offered by the Dharma. Glorious Dharma Kirti at your feet, I pray. You set alight the lamp which illuminates the text of ornament of realization and the meaning of transcendent wisdom passed down by Asanga and his brother in accordance with the Madhyamaka tradition beyond all extremes existing and non-existing. Arya Vimukti Sena, at your feet I pray, as prophesied by the Buddha, you explain the Mother Pranjaparamita and according to the instructions received from the protector Maitreya, clarify the three mothers. The supreme scriptures and transcendent wisdom, Acharya Hari Bhadra, to you I pray. So now let's go through. So regarding the Bodhicitta Vivarana and the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, as I said before, so philosophy is the support for the religious beliefs. For example, in the case of the theistic religions, creator God becomes the philosophical idea on which they base their belief, belief system. In India, there is the non-theistic philosophical tradition or philosophical idea or concept of the law of causality on the basis of which things are explained. So with regard to this text, commentary on awakening mind, written by Master Nagarjuna, it's a short text, but covers the entire spectrum of the Buddha's teaching. So therefore, I chose this text for this teaching to the Tibetan youth this time, and also on to go about with the daily practice of the teaching of the Buddha, I chose the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, written by the renowned Bodhisattva, who was well known as a Bodhisattva, I guess a Thokme Sangpo, wrote this text. And so we have discussed a lot in the last 2 days with regard to the teaching of the Buddha when it comes to practicing it. In the 400 verses, it says, first, get rid of the non-meritorious practices, and then in the middle, get rid of the notion of an independent self, and then finally, destroy all views. And such a person is a wise one. And then in Ratnavali by Master Nagarjuna, gives the teachings on pertaining to higher rebirth and then liberation, which are and so with regards to the factors leading to higher rebirth, he gives 16 different factors, 6 on top of the 10 avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions. So with regard to the teaching of the Buddha, there are monastic vows that the monks must give, which includes avoiding taking meals after after lunch. And then, but then there are certain exceptions when a monk becomes sick, and in order to sustain the body, they are allowed to take, permitted to take meals even after lunch. And but then, regarding the taking alcohol, it is not permitted at all. So what, why this is so is, I mean, it has its own significance, because if you are drunk, then your mind becomes rather dull and you cannot think clearly. And I mean, if that is the case in general, I mean, there's no way you can think about the teaching of the Buddha. And so not taking alcohol and not indulging in... not indulging in harming others, and so non-violence, in other words, even if it may be the very small practice of not harming others, you should still do it. And then helping others, animals, even I mean, when you see some animals being, I mean, drowning in a river or something, and you should save its life. And then those animals which live in water, if they are in stranded in on the dry land, you should put them back in water and so forth. So in this way, you should help save lives. And then in today, there are many humanitarian organizations which help very poor, needy people. So, for example, when we became exiles, I mean, many of these humanitarian organizations helped us. Last year or something, some time ago, I heard on BBC that in Nigeria or somewhere, in some part of Nigeria or something, some people have this belief that some children are born due to some kind of a negative influence from some negative spirits, and such children are actually abandoned. Nobody takes care of such children. There is such a belief. And so, in Netherlands or somewhere, a person from Netherlands or somewhere sold their house and went to Nigeria, and these so in Tibetan belief, we also do consider some children as being children of ghosts. And so these the Dutch people went to Nigeria to take care of these abandoned children. So I really appreciate such effort. And so we can see so many children suffering like that. And so these humanitarian acts are really precious. And from amongst the Christians or Muslims or Jews, there are people who really do engage in such humanitarian help. So such is also an act of making offerings. So giving, in other words, this is an act of giving with respect, so which is one of the factors, 16 factors for higher rebirth. So of course we do make offering to lamas and then come to the temples and make offerings, but when we meet with beggars who beg from us, I mean, we should not look down upon them when we make give alms, but we should actually do so with respect. So when you find people like that, you should actually consider them to be higher than yourself, viewing yourself to be lower than them, and thereby practice giving with respect, or respectfully giving. So these are the different factors for higher rebirth. And then through the meditation on emptiness, one should create the causes for definitive goodness, which means the liberation. So all the religious traditions, whether Christianity or Islam or Judaism, Hinduism, and so forth, all of these practice and religions have the practice of love and compassion, and therefore they do and they have practices of serving and benefiting human beings. And so I find that they have the practice leading to a higher rebirth. So regarding avoiding non-meritorious actions, of course, there may be different reasons given from different traditions. And then the second line, the 400 verses, says, getting rid of this notion of a self. And then finally, it says in the third line, getting rid of even the impressions or imprints left by these negative emotions. We consider the Prasangika Madhyamakas to be the Madhyamakas to be the highest school of philosophy, not because it is said propounded by Master Nagarjuna, but we actually do check the teaching itself with regard to, for example, the teaching on selflessness. So the other schools' presentation or interpretation of selflessness are good, but still you'll find logical inconsistencies in their thesis. But regarding Master Nagarjuna's philosophical understanding, it is something which can be verified through reason thoroughly. And so the philosophical schools are considered lower or higher on the basis of reasoning. And so in the middle, get rid of the notion of a self, and finally, and at the end, get rid of all distorted views. And so it's not just believing in the teaching, but actually supporting your belief with reason and logic. And so this is the way to go about with the practice of the teaching of the Buddha. And if you practice in this way, then you are a wise one, it says in the 400 verses. So let's go through the text on page 97, English, I think. So there is English translation, Hindi translation, Chinese. Chinese and then Spanish. Spain. So, but the title of the text is a commentary to on the awakening mind.
Thank you.
This title is given, derived from the content or the subject matter of the text. So regarding awakening mind or bodhicitta, mainly the reference here is the ultimate bodhicitta. So of the two, conventional ultimate, it is the ultimate bodhicitta. which is that mind or cognition which realizes emptiness directly. So this bodhicitta, which is, it's not just a mind which is realizes emptiness directly, just any kind of mind, but it is that state of mind where you, all the gross states of mind have dissolved, and you are left with this subtle, clear-light mind which realizes emptiness. And so this is the reference here of the awakening mind. So in the case, in the terminology of Guhya Samaja, there are the generation and completion stage practices, and within the completion stage there is the isolation of mind, speech, body, and then the clear light or luminosity, and then union. So having realized or having accomplished the illusory body, then you have all the factors to eliminate all the defilements from one's mind stream. And so on the basis of attaining this illusory body, you create, I mean, the causes for accruing merits very quickly and with ease. And then you use the analogy or example clear light, which is used to realize emptiness directly. And when you are able to realize emptiness directly with that mind, then you have this clear light mind of a trainee level, a union. So this mind, which realizes emptiness at that stage, is the ultimate bodhicitta referred in Guhya Samaja. And then the first verse that is quoted here comes from Guhya Samaja Tantra. So this verse, which teaches the bodhicitta, this ultimate bodhicitta, is because of this subject matter, this text is named after it. So in the Buddhist literature or the collection of Kanjur and Tinjur, we have some texts which are translated from Chinese, maybe 8 or 10 different texts. And one of them is a commentary on Sandhi Nimocana Sutra by an author named Wenzek. So the children may know that Abhisamaya Alamkara was written by Maitreya. And when you ask who is Maitreya, you would maybe answer that he lives in or resides in the 33 realm or heaven. And so on top of the Mount Meru, there is the realm of God named free from conflict, and then above that is said to be God, the Dushita heaven. And one of the as part of the Dushita heaven, in one of the one side of this Dushita heaven lives Maitreya, and he's said to be the future Buddha. So he in this Maitreya, of course, is a deity. So whether he was born through miraculous, miraculous ways or whatever, he's a deity. But according to Wenzek's commentary on the unraveling sutra, unraveling the thought. He mentions that Maitreya was born from a human parent. And so it seems the author of Abhisamayalamkara was a human being. And so some Chinese scholars with whom I had discussion about the author Maitreya, they also say that Maitreya was a human being. But whatever the case, whether he was, I mean, he is a deity or a human being, he was a human being, his text is excellent. And so there are about 10 volumes or so that were translated into Tibetan from Chinese, but the rest of the 300 volumes were translated from Sanskrit or Indian language, and therefore in the beginning of the text we find mention of in the language of India, Bodhicitta Vivarana. And then translated into Tibetan, it says in the Tibetan language, Changchub Semki Delpa. And because this text is related to Tantra, this homage to homage by translator is made to Vajrasattva. So when the texts were being translated into Tibetan in this 7th, 8th centuries, then by the decree of the Tibetan emperors, it was established that the texts which come under the sutra were Sutra, Abhidhamma, and Vinaya have different deities to whom the translators are supposed to make their homage. So maybe the Tibetan emperors didn't have much time to read all the texts, but just by looking at the homage to whom these at the beginning of these texts, they may be able to identify, and for the sake of the easy identification of these texts, I mean, maybe they made this kind of established this kind of decree. So these Tibetan emperors were really learned. So according to searching the Golden Rosary by Master Tsongkhapa, which is a commentary to Abhisamayalamkara, he mentions this. And so with regards to the glorious, the term glorious, it is a reference to the illusory body, which is the ultimate cause for the Rupakaya. And then for the Dharmakaya, the ultimate cause is the luminous mind. So the pure state of illusory body and clear light, the union of it, is brought about by these two causes. So Vajrasattva could refer to the union state. So because of being qualified by this union, he's referred to as the sattva. So Vajra refers to that union, and sattva means the great hero. And then says devoid of all real entities, utterly discarding all objects and subjects such as aggregates, elements, and sense field due to the sameness of self and of all phenomena. One's mind is primarily unborn. It is the nature of emptiness. So this comes from the second chapter of Guhya Samaja Tantra. So to give you a brief explanation, So with regards to the explanation of these lines, I mean this text, it seems there are two or three commentaries to this text by in the collection of in the treatises written by Indian masters in Tengur. So maybe there are commentaries also by Tibetan masters as well. But I had a look at Indian commentaries, like the commentary by Smriti Gyanakirti. So it's a very good commentary. So I had a look at it just recently. So he gives a structural outline. But when it comes to when he identifies the three, what are known as the three natures according to Chittamatra philosophy, of course, I may not be qualified to say this, but from my reading, I found that his identification of the three natures may not be correct. So we need to actually look at many different texts and compare them, not just confine ourselves to a single commentary. So there are texts that are written by Bhavviveka and Buddhapalita, Chandrakirti, and so forth, which must be read and together and then compare them. And so Master Bhavviveka's Tarujavala and then Chandrakirti's Prasanapada and so forth must be read side by side. And so regarding these lines, devoid of all real entities, refers to the fact that in Buddhism there is selflessness, the theory of selflessness, but apart from Buddhism, all the rest of the philosophical schools or the religious traditions have this idea of an independent self. So there is reason for them also to assert a self, independent self, because they talk about past and future lives. And so this body does not go from one life to the next, but so regarding myself, I'm 82, 83 years old now. So this body, when I think about this body, I don't think that this body was there when I was a child. But the sense of an I, a notion of an I, is always there. I can still think that I was there when I was a child. I was there in my mother's womb. And so there is this sense of the notion of an I in everyone. And then we also see my body and my mind. And therefore, there is also this notion, there is some entity which actually possesses or this body and the mind. And so the body decays, arises in the case, and then the mind related to this body also arises and goes away. But the sense of an I is seen as something unchanging, permanent, single and autonomous. Whereas with regard to the body and the gross mind, we can talk about this body and the mind changing. We can talk about the body and the mind when I was young and old and so forth. And so these different religious traditions which believe in a self, independent self, have some reason to assert it. And so this self is said to be permanent, unchanging. But when you actually logically put it under the lens of logical investigation, there will be logical inconsistencies. And then if this self that is within oneself is permanent, you cannot talk about it as being female or male. And then if it's not unrelated to the body and the mind, we cannot say I'm sick or I'm well and so forth. Mm-hmm. But then when you say my body or my mind, this self, the notion of self, is somehow arises in conjunction with the body and the mind as well. And so the first line, devoid of all real entities, so there are many different words that are used, synonyms or self, life, force, being, and so forth. And so, except Buddhism, all the religious traditions believe in what is known as Atman or soul. And so, this is what is referred to and rejected by the first line. And then regarding the aggregate elements, the 18 elements and 12 sense fields, and are the realist schools within Buddhism assert that these things have some objective existence from their own side. So like Vibhashikas, Sotantikas, I mean, this line is referenced to these two schools of philosophy within Buddhism. And then utterly discarding all objects and subjects is a reference to Chittamatra philosophy, who say that all the things, the objects that appear to our mind are just a reflection of the imprints which give rise to those the cognition of them. And so therefore, the objects and their cognition are of the same substance. And so this line in English translation is given a second line. It's a reference to the refutation of Chittamatra. And then, due to sameness of selflessness of all phenomena, there are those who say that, who make this distinction between the subject and object of mind, and then saying that there is no external object, but then the subject of mind exists. Without being contented with the mere appearance of things, if you try to check how things are, whether they have some independent existence or not, of course you'll not find it. And therefore, it says one's mind is primordially unborn. It is in the nature of emptiness. So just as the blessed Buddhas and the great Bodhisattvas have generated the mind of great awakening, I too shall from now until I arrive at the heart of awakening generate the awakening mind in order that I may save those who are not saved, free those who are not freed, relieve those who are not relieved, and help thoroughly transcend sorrow, those who have not thoroughly transcended sorrow. So, in order to have this ultimate mind, bodhicitta, you need to have this mind, develop a mind which can serve as an antidote to not only the negative, destructive emotions alone, but even the imprints left by them. So the realization of emptiness must be to overcome all negative emotions and their imprints. And so with regards to meditation on emptiness, Master Nagarjuna, in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika, uses all kinds of reasonings, checking or examining things from the point of view of their cause and effect and identity and so forth. And so he uses so many different reasonings, because the objective is to attain full enlightenment, to overcome all stains or defilements in the mind. which cannot happen without the help of bodhicitta, this altruistic spirit of enlightenment. And therefore, so he says, it says in the text, the awakening mind, generate awakening mind. So in Master Vimukti Sena, in his commentary to Avisamaya Alamkara, together with aligning it with the there of the 25,000 verses of Prajnaparamita, and then also Haribhadra's great commentary on the 8,000 verses of Panchaparamita, either this one or the other one, and it's mentioned that with compassion the bodhisattvas look at sentient beings, whereas with the wisdom they focus their mind on enlightenment. So when we talk about cultivating bodhicitta on the basis of the sevenfold cause and effect system, we are talking about thinking of serving other sentient beings. But then when it comes to think about whether it's possible to achieve that goal or not, how do we do that? Is by that we should help others so that they are able to overcome their ignorance. As I have already quoted the Buddha, these lines where it said that the Buddhas do not wash away the sins of sentient beings, nor do they remove their suffering with their hands, nor do they shift their own realization into others, but by teaching, by giving teachings in accordance, with the mental dispositions or proclivity and interest of sentient beings, by knowing them precisely, they should be able to teach. So until one has overcome what is known as the obscuration to knowledge from within one's mind, there's no way one can do that. One can see the mental dispositions of others precisely down to the smallest details. Although the bodhisattvas are on the high grounds of bodhisattvas, and also Shravakas and Pacheka Buddha, Arahats and so forth, can help sentient beings to a certain degree, but not fully. And therefore, the omniscient ones, the Buddhas, are the ones who are able to help sentient beings to overcome their defilements and suffering and so forth, and show the paths to them precisely. And therefore, the either Vimukti Sena or Haribhadra has mentioned that with compassion, the bodhisattvas watch the sentient beings, and with their wisdom, they focus their mind on this omniscient state of Buddhahood. And therefore, these two words, which is in Tibetan, Chang Chub, this is the translation for Bodhi, refers to the purifying all negativities and being having full knowledge of everything. And then with regards to that, the purification, of course, we can talk about it in relation to attaining true cessation. And so with regard to true cessation, of course, there are different interpretations according to the different philosophical schools within Buddhism. And then Tibetan interpreters have different interpretations, whether true cessation is emptiness or whether it's just that fact of having eliminated the negative emotions from within one's mind. So there are different ideas that are put forth by Tibetan scholars, which shows that we are Tibetans, that these Tibetan scholars were really intelligent. So Panchen Sonam Thakpa says that cessation is not is that state of having abandoned negativities. Gyenma Gelsen used to praise Gungin Jamyang Shepa's interpretations very good. And so when I actually related what Gyenma Gelsen told me to my senior tutor, late senior tutor, Ling Rinpoche immediately responded, no, that's not true. Mpenjin Sonam Thapa, who came from Zethang, and his interpretation is excellent. And so there has been this tradition within Tibetan Buddhists that scholars did not or do not accept whatever others say, but they do their own investigation into the teachings thoroughly. So, being complemented by this the awakening mind, bodhicitta, the realization or the view of emptiness. So those bodhisattvas who practice by means of secret mantra after having generated awakening mind in terms of its conventional aspect and the form of aspiration must then produce an ultimate awakening mind. And so forth. And I shall therefore explain its nature. Bowing to the glorious Vajra holder, who embodies the awakening mind, I shall explain here the meditative practice of the awakening mind that destroys cyclic existence. So in the Tibetan text that is printed in this book, that regard His Holiness is just wondering if this spelling is correct. It says from this wording, actually, it turns the Vajra holder into a plural term. He only thinks this is not the case. And then, so who destroys the awakening mind, who embodies of the awakening mind that destroys cyclic existence. So this destroying in the Tibetan should be also made into an instrumental case. So with regard to selflessness, there are different understandings of it, which is refuting self, which is merely refuting that self, which is permanent, single and autonomous, or refuting a self, which is self-sufficiently, substantially existent, or refuting the idea that things have any kind of external existence, or the refutation of selflessness, which is established by saying that things do not exist, apart from being designated by an unerred mind, and so forth. So the Buddhas maintain the awakening mind to be not obscured by conceptions referring to these different philosophical ideas of the philosophical schools. As it is said in Heart Sutra, form is empty, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness too is not other than emptiness. And then there's no I, no form, no sound, and so forth. And so what we need to understand here is that when we talk about emptiness, nothing should be remains when one refutes any kind of objective existence in things. So all objectification of things, reifications, must be destroyed. So I tell you a story. There were two Amdo guys And one of them knew the Heart Sutra by heart, and the other did not. And so the person A, knowing the Heart Sutra by heart, recited it in front of the other one really proudly. And as he recited, the second person was hearing him recite, "There's no eye, no ear, no nose, no ear, tongue," and so forth. And you didn't have to struggle so much by saying no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue. You could just have said there's no head. So when the Heart Sutra says form is not, there's no form, it does not literally mean form is non-existent. But what is meant by this negation is that when we think about some an eye or a form, like a pillar, for example, these things appear as if they have some independent objective existence from their own side. And therefore, in order to understand this, the meaning, we need to study Madhyamaka philosophy. And within the Madhyamaka philosophy, there are those who still accept some kind of objective existence and things, whereas others reject this. And so, for example, Bhava Viveka was one who has accepted objective existence and things. And so, Mula Madhyamaka Karika is precisely and thoroughly explained by Chandrakirti in his Prasannapada, and also Madhyamaka Avatara. And so we need to study these texts and then reflect on them thoroughly. So, for example, if someone says there is a ghost in this, and what do you understand when someone answers, there is no ghost, but what idea do you get? This statement implies there's something, doesn't it? Whereas when someone says, "and there's no ghost at all," then you have another impression. So with regard to emptiness, it should be understood in terms of a negation whereby you there's no implication of any objective, any object. So the lower schools of philosophical schools within Buddhism say that when they say a valid cognition must be a newly arisen cognition of the object. And so when they define valid cognition like that, they still have this notion that the objects have some existence from their own side, whereas the Prasangikas reject any and all objective existence and things, and therefore, and then with regards to the destruction of an object, the lower schools say that when you talk about a destruction of an object or something being something that has disintegrated, and once it has disintegrated, I mean, the object is no more there, and therefore the disintegration itself, the disintegratedness itself, is a permanent an object. Whereas Chandrakirti actually rejects that and says the disintegratedness of an object is a compounded phenomena which arises through causes and conditions. So when you reflect on emptiness, I mean, there is some kind of fear that develops in people when they say there's when they come to the conclusion that, I mean, after doing all and kinds of analysis into things, nothing is found. But then, after that, post when you reflect on how things exist and come to understand that they are merely designated and therefore they do not have any objective existence, but they are merely designated. And so these understandings develop through familiarization with this view of emptiness. And so when you establish emptiness, you need to destroy any and all objectification in things, because there is this notion and the grasping at some objective existence, even if when you meditate on emptiness. And so you should know how this view of emptiness actually damages our own notion of things. And so it is always characterized by emptiness. It is with a mind moistened by compassion that you must cultivate awakening mind with effort. The Buddhas who embodied great compassion constantly develop this awakening. And then from verse number 4 begins the refutation of non-Buddhist assertions of non-Buddhist schools. The self postulated by the extremists, when you thoroughly analyze it with reasoning, within all the aggregates of body and mind, nowhere can you find a locus for this. And so the aggregates of body and mind change. The self cannot be posited from within the body or amongst the body if it's a permanent object which undergoes no change. Nowhere can you find the locus for it. Aggregates exist but are not permanent. They do not have the nature of selfhood. Something permanent and something impermanent cannot exist as the support and the supported. It is so-called self does not. If the so-called self does not exist, how can the so-called agent be permanent? If there were things there, then you could investigate their attributes in the world. So the word for investigation in the Tibetan text is strong. It should be the investigation, but not this word. Since something impermanent cannot function as a cause in gradual or instantaneous terms, so both without and within, no such permanent entity exists. If it were potent, why would it be dependent? For it would bring forth everything at once. That which depends upon something else is neither eternal nor potent. If it were an entity, it would not be permanent, for entities are always momentary. And with respect to impermanent entities, agency has not been negated. This world, devoid of self and so on, is utterly vanquished by the notions of aggregates, elements, and the sense worlds, and object and subject. Thus the Buddha, who seek to help others, have taught disciples the five aggregates: form, feeling, perception, volition, forces, and consciousness. The most excellent among those who walk on two legs always taught as well. Forms appear as a mass of foam. Feelings resemble bubbles in water, and perception is like a mirage. Mental formations are like the plantain tree. Consciousness is like a magical illusion. Presenting the aggregates in this manner, the Buddha taught the Bodhisattvas in this way. That which is characterized by the four great elements is clearly taught to be an aggregate of form. The rest are invariably established, therefore, as devoid of material form. In this way, the eyes, visible form, and so forth, which are described as the elements, these should be known also as the 12 sense fields, and as the object and subjects as well. An atom of form neither exists, nor is a sense organ elsewhere. What's more, no sense organ exists as an agent. So the producer and the produced are utterly unsuited for production. The atoms of form do not produce sense perceptions, for they transcend the realm of the senses. If it is asserted that they are produced through aggregation, production through a collection too is not accepted. So just read through. So from verse number 26 gives the Chittamatra view. For those who will profound consciousness only, this manifold world is established as mind only. What might be the nature of that consciousness? I shall now explain this very point. All of this is but one's mind. That which was stated by the Able One is to alleviate the fear of the childish. It is not a statement of final truth, the imputed, the dependent, and the consummate. So having so with regards to the material things, they have special extension, whereas when it comes to consciousness, they only can be talked of in terms of temporal extension or continuity. And so when you talk about a second of a moment of a moment of consciousness, you can talk about a moment in terms of a second, but half of it is gone and half is yet to come, and you cannot have a present. And as such, that you can pinpoint. So that which is past is no more, and so forth. Verse number 31 down. So, having ascertained yourself and have others ascertain the learning proceeds excellently, always without error. So in order to teach others, you have to know what you are going to teach them. There is no way you can do that without knowing it yourself. So the verse number 39 was which is almost referring to. So having a certain 38, having a certain yourself to help others a certain then learn it proceeds and so forth, and the cognizer perceives and the cognizable. So when you check into the things, of course you'll find nothing that you can actually pinpoint as being this that, but that doesn't mean that things do not exist at all. And so things do exist. From our experience, we can tell that they exist. And so how do they exist? Only by way of designation. And so this really goes with reality. So when you do try to search for the identity of things in themselves, that you cannot find anything. But that nothing can be found when you do critical analysis into these as them, but they still do exist. There's no denial of it, and therefore, how do they exist? It's by way of mere name, and therefore, the text says in verse number 40, the mind is but a mere name. Apart from this, its name, it exists as nothing. So, view consciousness as mere name. Name too has no intrinsic nature. So when you are able to ascertain that things have no objective independent existence whatever, then your grasping and this clinging to things and being becoming attached or becoming angry at them and so forth, also their intensity decreases. So either within or likewise without, or somewhere in between the two, the conqueror has never found the mind. So the mind has the nature of an illusion and so forth. Verse number 46, devoid of characteristics and origination, devoid of substantive reality and transcending speech, space, awakening mind and enlightenment possess the characteristics of non-duality. Verse number 47, 48. The notion of virtue and non-virtue characterized by being momentary, and the known origination of all phenomena is clearly taught to be emptiness. Momentary and disintegrated, the Buddha has spoken of the emptiness. Other than this, no emptiness is held. So just as when you talk about this empty this space, it is the uncompounded space is explained as that which is the absence of any obstruction. So that's a negation, a negative term. And likewise, emptiness, when you talk about emptiness, it is that mere negation or absence of any independent existence. So other than this, no emptiness is held. Verse number 51 down. The abiding of a mind which has no object is defined as a characteristic of space. So they accept that the meditation on emptiness is in fact a meditation on space. By the lion's roar of emptiness, all pronouncements are frightened. Wherever such speakers reside, their emptiness lies in wait. To whom consciousness is momentary, to them it cannot be permanent. So, if the mind is impermanent, how could it be inconsistent with emptiness? So those who assert emptiness are not nihilists. They still do accept the conventionality of things. So those asserting emptiness do accept, do assert dependent origination as well. So it's verse number 58, His Holiness was commenting, when you speak of emptiness as nature of phenomena, in no sense do you propound nihilism. By the same token, you do not propound eternalism either. Starting with ignorance and ending with aging, all processes that arise from the 12 links of dependent origination we accept to be like a dream and an illusion. And so, causes different, giving rise to the effects, and effects arising from the cause and so forth are merely designated by name and through origination dependence. And apart from being dependent, there is nothing that exists. So the conventional is taught to be emptiness. The conventional arises, and emptiness itself is the convention. One does not occur without the other, just as being produced and impermanent. The conventional arises from afflictions and karma arises from the mind. The mind is accumulated by the propensities. So those who do not understand emptiness are not a receptive vehicle of liberation. Such ignorant beings will revolve in the prison of existence of the six classes of beings. When this emptiness, as explained, is meditated upon by yogis in this way, no doubt there will be a rise in them, a sentiment attached to others. And so this is a very crucial point. Verse number 73. With regard to those beings that have bestowed benefits upon me in the past by being my parents and or friends, I shall strive to repay their kindness. To those beings that are being scorched by the fire of afflictions and so forth. God. Seventy-six down shows bodhicitta. So because we consider ourselves to be more important than others, and others to be insignificant, we actually do things that harm others and try to help oneself. And so all kinds of negative things that we do ensue from this self-cherishing attitude. So avoiding killing, for example, may be done by thinking that if I kill others, I mean, I'll have to suffer the consequence. Whereas it can, this same act of killing could also be understood in terms of, if I kill others, of course, the others whom I killed would have suffering. And so you are more concerned of the suffering of others than yourself alone. And therefore, through bodhicitta, you actually will be able to attain the higher rebirth easily and with less difficulty. As Maitreya's prayer says, it is that which avoids the lower realms of existence and leads you to higher realms of existence and then the state of immortality. And therefore, I pay homage to bodhicitta. Call this. If by relying upon sentient beings, the unexalted state of Buddhahood is brought about, what is astonishing about the fact that whatever prosperity there is among gods and humans, so everything that good that happens to us is thanks to sentient beings, but because of our self-cherishing attitude, we actually undergo incessant suffering and misery, causing harm to others and so forth. Such as that enjoyed by Brahma, Indra, Rudra, and the world guardians of the world, there is nothing in this triple world system that is not brought about forth by helping others. So, not being compassionate to sentient beings, but completely neglecting them should be considered like a poison. So, disregarding others must be seen as a poison, and embracing them as like a nectar. So this is Buddhahood and awakening and the fortunate birth and the unfortunate birth on the earth. Know that the karmic fruition of beings is twofold. So if you actually consider others to be more important than oneself and work for them and cultivate this altruistic intention or the spirit of enlightenment, you will be able to fulfill your own goal easily. So, 88, verse number 85. So with the twofold aspiration to help others, serve others, and aspiration to attain Buddhahood, the bodhisattvas engage in their practices. So when through practice it becomes firm, then alarmed by others' suffering, the bodhisattvas renounce the bliss of concentration and plunge even to the depths of relentless hells. This is indeed amazing, praiseworthy it is. This is the excellent way of the sublime, that they give away their own flesh and wealth is not surprising at all. So when the first Dalai Lama Gendun Drup was getting old, so he had many great students who were very learned, and they said that when the first Dalai Lama Gendun Drup was complaining about his age, and these students said, "Oh, you have prophecy that you will be born in pure land," but his response was that, "I have no intention to be born in pure land. In fact, I wish to be born where there is suffering, and that I can help sentient beings." And so this is how the bodhisattvas think. It's their natural feeling to help others. So if you do not exchange one's own happiness with the suffering of others, there's leave alone attaining Buddhahood. Even in samsara, you'll not have happiness, Shantideva says. And then he says, which intelligent person feels discouraged to ride the horse of bodhicitta, which leads one from bliss to bliss. And so I have meditated on bodhicitta for a long time, for 40, 50 years. And then it really helps transformation within oneself. And this also helps, transformation also helps with the help of this wisdom or the understanding of emptiness, so that it doesn't become just a word that one could say that this is something that is taught in the text, but it becomes your own experience. And so they really help. So they plunge to the depths of hell, relentless hell, hells. This is indeed amazing, praiseworthy it is. This is the excellent way of the sublime. They give away their own flesh and wealth is not surprising at all. Those who understand this emptiness of phenomena, yet also conform to the law of karma and its results, that is more amazing than amazing, that is more wondrous than the wondrous. Those who wish to save sentient beings, even if they are reborn in the mire of existence, are not sullied by the stains of its events, just like the petals of lotus bone in a lake. Though Bodhisattvas and Samantabhadra have burned the wood of afflictions with the wisdom fire of emptiness, they still remain moistened by compassion. And so the 12 deeds of the Buddhas also are the results of bodhicitta. So those who are under the power of compassion display acts of departing birth, merriment. So these are those 12 deeds of the enlightened deeds of the Buddha. Renouncing kingdom, engaging in ascetic penance, great awakening and defeating the Maras, turning the wheel of Dharma and entering the realm of all gods, and likewise display the act of going beyond the bounds of sorrow. In the guise of Brahma, Indra, Vishnu, or the fierce form of Rudra, they reform the compassionate dance with acts bringing. So verse number 99 down. Instructions may be profound or vast, or some occasions an instruction is characterized by both. Though such diverse approaches are taught, they are all equal in being empty and non-dual. So neither in cycling existence nor in nirvana resides the great beings. Therefore, the Buddha has taught here the non-abiding nirvana. The single taste of compassion is merit. The taste of emptiness is most excellent. Those who drink the elixir of emptiness to realize self and others' welfare are the conqueror's children. So those bodhisattvas who cultivate and who have developed the bodhicitta are the ones who have used this human brain, this marvelous human brain, to its full potential. So bow to them with entire being. Verse number 104. So this is amazing. So we are supposed to be the ones who are emulating this path, having received the teaching on this commentary on an awakening mind. I'm a senior practitioner who does this practice, and I have many friends who do the same practice, and I have found it really beneficial and have experienced this. And so you are the ones who are going to be doing the same to continue this tradition. And so we have the facilities for doing this practice, to keep up with this practice. The practice of bodhicitta combined with the wisdom of emptiness. These guides of the world reside as representatives of the Buddhas. This awakening mind is stated to be the highest ideal in the great vehicle. So, with an absorbed, determined effort, regenerate this awakening mind. To accomplish your own and others' welfare, no other means exist in the world. Apart from the awakening mind, to date, the Buddha saw no other means. The merit is that is obtained from the generation of awakening mind, if it were to assume form, would more than fill the expanse of space. A person who, for an instant, meditates on awakening mind, the heap of merit obtained from this cannot be measured even by the conquerors. A precious mind that is free of afflictions, is the most unique and excellent jewel. It can be neither harmed nor stolen by robbers as the mara of destructive emotions. Just as aspiration of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are unswerving, likewise, those who immerse themselves in the awakening mind must hold their thought firm. So even with wonder, you should strive, as explained here in these preceding lines. Therefore, you will yourself realize Samantabhadra's great enlightened deeds. And then the final verse is dedication verse. This concludes our commentary on the awakening mind composed by the great master Aryanagarjuna. It was translated and edited by the Indian abbot Gunakara and translated Rabshi Shenyan, and was later revised by the Indian abbot Kanaka Varma and the Tibetan translator Patsam Nyima Thak. And then the book that was distributed also contains a commentary. So I have there is an audience at the end. And then with regard to the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, so I'll not give a reading transmission of the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, but we'll do the ceremony for Bodhicitta. So in the space before you, imagine the incomparable kind teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, who gave the teaching on who taught Buddhism, and then it was explained by the great masters of India, such as Nagarjuna and his disciples, and Sangha and his disciples, and so forth. And then these teachings were brought to Tibet, and we, as Tibetans, have kept this tradition alive, and this teaching is tradition is a treasure of the world, we can say. So, in the 20th century, and of course, people of my century, my generation, also have kept this tradition. And so, my generation will slowly finish, but 15, 20, or 30 years from now, my generation will be gone. And so, at that time, you would recount, and you should be able to recall that our elder generation used to say such and such things, teach us this, and then so that you could practice this tradition and also pass down to the next generations. So I usually talk about following the Dharma based on reason, so that you are a follower who are of the sharper faculty, and in that way the Dharma, I say, would remain for centuries, few more centuries. Whereas if you follow the Dharma just those of Dalvitit, based on faith alone, then maybe, we don't know how long the Dharma will remain. And so, I'm 82 years old, and I have told in South India once that the monks and the scholars in these monastic institutions should really keep up with the teaching, the practice of this tradition that we have, and so that I could die in about 20 years' time. When I die, I could die rather contented and without any worries. And so you should also, I would like to say here too, that you should let me die peacefully and without any worry. So this Nalanda tradition of Buddhist philosophy that we have, which is explained through reason and logic, and must be kept by us Tibetans, continue to be kept by us Tibetans for generations on. So for the Bodhicitta ceremony, imagine the Buddha Shakyamuni in person, surrounded by this close Bodhisattva disciples, and then the great masters like Nagarjuna and so forth. And then the great upholders of the tradition of Tibet, the traditions of Tibet, the Buddhist traditions, and then also great masters of China who brought Buddhism to China, and then there are Vietnamese and Koreans and so forth, and also here, and also Japanese people are here. So the forebears of your countries who brought Buddhism to your countries, and also those who have kept up with the teaching and continued the teaching, you could imagine the great masters of those great masters of the past also. And then there are people from France here which used traditionally didn't used to be a Buddhist country as such, but because of finding interest in Buddhism, you're following it. So of course there is no, there were no past great masters of France and so forth, the Western countries, who were the upholders of the Dharma as such. So you could imagine those great masters of Tibet and India and Bodhisattvas and the Buddha, Shakyamuni himself, as I have already said. So in other words, imagine all the objects of refuge before whom you could accumulate merit and purify negativities. And also, if you add a third practice, which is to proliferate those two accumulations of merit and wisdom, which is done through rejoicing in the merits. So let's say this prayer. I dedicate all the merit and wisdom that I have accumulated through prostration, making offering, rejoicing, and confession, and then requesting the Buddhas not to pass away but turn the wheel of Dharma. I dedicate all the virtues through prostration, making offerings, and so forth for enlightenment. Yesterday, somebody recited this verse, I seek refuge in the Triple Jewel. I confess all misdeeds individually. So his Holiness was asking where that child's student is. So here we are not doing Bodhisattva vows as such. You're not going to take Bodhisattva vows, but what you're going to go through is cultivating Bodhicitta. Although this text is used for Bodhisattva vows, but here we are not doing that. So in the text it says, to fulfill the interest of oneself and others, I shall generate the mind for awakening. So this mind of awakening mind is that factor which brings one's own welfare as well as others' welfare. And so, in other words, thinking of benefiting others is the sole factor for one's own good and good of others. And so, in front of these great masters of the past, around the Buddha, you should reflect on the fact that you have found this human existence in this life and met with the teaching of the Buddha, and so you have the opportunity to practice it. So far, because of my selfish attitude, self-cherishing attitude, I have disregarded others' well-being and welfare and only thought of myself alone. And now, due to the teaching of the Buddha and the great masters, I have understood that cherishing others over oneself is greater benefit to oneself and others than cherishing oneself, and therefore have this determination to reach Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings, so that you have these two aspirations: aspiration to become a fully enlightened being, a Buddha, and aspiration to help others. And therefore you take refuge in the three jewels, saying, "I seek refuge in the three jewels," with that intention to become a Buddha. I confess all misdeeds individually. And so, including the 7 billion people and on this earth, as well as all other sentient beings, are the ones to whom I should bring benefit. And so, I rejoice in the virtues of all beings. I take to mind Buddha's enlightenment. To the Buddha Dharma and his highest assembly, I seek refuge until I reach enlightenment. To fulfill the interests of oneself and others, I should generate awakening mind. Having generated the awakening mind of highest awakening mind, I shall invite all sentient beings as my guests. So we have the opportunity to help others to cultivate this cherishing others over oneself. So as Tibetans, you students, once you have completed your studies in school and you go into higher studies and then complete them, and with the help through this tradition, Buddhist tradition that we have, you could help Indians and then also other friends. And our Dharma friends from China, and the Chinese, Koreans, Vietnamese, Japanese, and so forth, also could help your own people as well. And then the Westerners who come from countries which were not traditionally Buddhist countries, but all of us are same in the sense that we are, in being human beings. So as humans, we have the same. We are same. Of course, we have different nationalities and so forth, but that's secondary. So I always think that all of us are same in being human beings. And I don't really consider myself as being a Buddhist or Tibetan and so forth, because that doesn't help much. And so, maybe you have seen, wherever I go, I easily make friends with others because I am quite open to people. And so when I was visiting Tawang on the way, I met with an Indian politician, and we became friends. And then I told him I sleep 9 hours, and then when I wake up in the morning, after waking up, I do meditate for 5 hours or so, and so that I can sharpen my mind, and so that I could deceive others. And so he said that he could sleep only 6 hours, therefore he cannot deceive others, cheat others. So I don't find any barrier when I think that everyone, all of us are same. So with this sense of being human, I mean, it really helps me to gain more friends. If I emphasize I am the Dalai Lama, I become lonely, because there's only one Dalai Lama. If I emphasize it, I would be left alone. Whereas when I think, wherever I go, whether in India or abroad, with this attitude that we are all same human beings, I get more friends, easily make friends with others. So nationality, ideology, and so forth are secondary. If we emphasize this secondary nature, I mean, what is benefit? What is the benefit for us? It leads to discrimination and division, and then people actually cause harm to each other, deceive others, and then even go to the length of killing one another. So we are not saying that, on the level of being humans, that we should have this sense of oneness. Doesn't mean that we have to do this religion or that practice that or that, this or that religion as such. But with that attitude, we could help and be more friendly with others. So if you could actually spread this message of oneness of humanity to 10 friends, and also spread the thought of helping others, serving others. What it helps is you could help the world, you could help community, and then also it begins with individual, yourself, being more happier. And so, in this way, if you could spread the message of love, compassion towards others, to 10 friends, they could in turn spread it, each of them could spread it 10 others, and that makes 100, and so exponentially, it becomes, it would increase to 1,000 and 10,000 and so forth. So those who are around you, you should try your best to spread this message as best you can. And so in 20, 30 years' time, the result of such, cannot be seen, this kind of practice cannot be seen by me. So through education, we could actually make change, transform people's thinking and their behavior. And therefore, you have the responsibility to endeavor to spread this message and practice of love and compassion, thinking of benefiting others. So I may usually make this distinction between the generation of 20th and 21st centuries. So I belong to the 20th century, my generation, and in about 20 years' time, my generation would be gone. So I say that whether I reach, I'm reborn in a hell realm, for example, a heaven, even if I were in hell realm, I could seek a vacation for 1 week, to come to this world and watch your generation, the generation of 21st century, what you are doing. So if you have continued to live the way we have lived in the 20th century and not really giving thoughts to helping one another, benefiting one another through love, compassion, and so forth, but killing one another and so forth, I would go back to Hell Ram and tell the guardian of Hell that the Hell Ram should be expanded because there are many who are ready to come down. Whereas if you have changed this world, when I visit the world, not following in the footsteps of the generation of the 20th century, who indulged in killing and division and called dividing and people and so forth, but have actually changed the world for the better, then I would return to Hal Ram and tell the Hal Guardians that the size of the Hal could be reduced. So as Tibetans, those living in inside Tibet are undergoing a very difficult time. So even under such difficult situation, they have not lost this their spirit of being Tibetans. I mean, they, even though they're burning within, they are not able to let out the smoke. And we in exile in free country should be their representatives. So what we need to do, therefore, is to keep up with our own tradition, our religion, culture, language, which is what the our brothers and sisters inside Tibet wish to do, but they don't have that freedom, whereas we have the freedom to do that. And so, having generated the mind for highest awakening, which means this altruistic attitude, is something that we need to spread around the world. I shall invite all sentient beings as my guests. So if you live your life according to this principle of altruism, then you could tread along the path, beginning with the path of accumulation, going on to path of preparation or application, path of seeing, path of meditation, and then reaching the state of normal learning, Buddhahood. And I shall engage in the delightful supreme practices of enlightenment. May I attain Buddhahood to benefit all sentient beings. So with these lines, you should generate bodhicitta. So please repeat after me. Make a firm prayer and determination, just as the past Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the great masters of the past have done, I will do the same. I seek refuge in the three jewels. I confess all miseries individually. I rejoice in the virtuous deeds of all beings. I take to mind Buddha's enlightenment. The Buddha, Dharma, and his assembly. I seek refuge until I reach enlightenment. For the interest of oneself and others, I generate the mind for awakening. Having generated the mind for highest awakening, I shall invite all sentient beings as my guests. I shall engage in the delightful practices. May I attain Buddhahood to benefit all sentient beings. Please repeat for the second time. Here you are taking, generating bodhicitta. You are not thinking of taking bodhisattva vows as such. So in other words, by generating bodhicitta, you should think about being practical, about helping others. I seek refuge in the three jewels and confess all misdeeds individually. I rejoice in the virtues of all beings. I take to mind Buddha's enlightenment, to the Buddha, Dharma, and highest assembly. I seek refuge until I reach enlightenment. To fulfill the interests of oneself and others, I should generate mind for awakening. Having generated mind for highest awakening, I shall invite all sentient beings as my guests. I shall engage in the delightful supreme practices of enlightenment. May I attain Buddhahood to benefit all sentient beings. Please, having repeated for two times, now at the end of the third repetition, when you say, may I attain Buddhahood to benefit all sentient beings, you should make this determination that you will never leave this spirit of helping others, so that you could actually engage in with your body, mind, and speech to help others. In other words, your life should be dedicated for the benefit of all others. So this is
I think the determination should make.
May all sentient
beings, my parents, have happiness. May all hell realms be emptied. May all the prayers of bodhisattvas and prayers of all bodhisattvas be fulfilled. In short, Avalokiteshvara has made prayer to take care of these of the snowland. May this prayer be fulfilled.
Please
sit down. These are verses of dedication from Samadabhadra prayer. So we are done with the teaching this time to the Tibetan youth for this year. These grounds. So I'll be just sitting on my throne, and the students will have a photo session with